Welcome to Folkways, the Folklore of Britain and Ireland podcast. Yes, it's you. I'm so glad it's you. I'm so glad you found me. Well, we are fast approaching Samhain, Calan Gaeaf, or All Hallows. In light of this, I have somewhat of an atmospheric, creepy episode for you this month. So this episode deals with a story that is fairly well known in Fortean circles. However, I do have my reasons for including it, which I'll get to at the end. Partly due to Big Big Sky's somewhat terrifying soundtrack, I personally wouldn't listen to this before bed. But you know, it's up to you. It's your life. One morning in October 1957, three boys, all 15 years old, made their way across fields, ditches, and sties. Their boots were now encrusted with mud as they squinted, eyes crinkled, against the growing autumn sun. These lads were not friends. They'd been placed together for an orienteering exercise by the Royal Navy cadets. Not only were they not friends, but they were also all strangers to this particular place. The boys were William Lang from Perthshire, Scotland, Ray Baker from London, and Michael Crowley from Worcestershire. Each step, therefore, that the boys took in this particular patch of eastern England, southwest Suffolk, they took for the first time. Not only did what occur on this October morning in 1957 make its way firmly into the folklore of Suffolk, but it would become internationally renowned, with one of the boys, William Lang in particular, remaining unsettled by and unable to forget what happened this October morning for the rest of his life. You're listening to Season 3, Episode 7, Back Again. Map and compass in hands, William Lang, Ray Baker, and Michael Crowley reach the end of a public footpath across fields and, boots weighed down with fresh mud, found themselves on a narrow country road. They lifted the map high above their heads as their fingers traced their route so far. As cadets, they'd been challenged to find a specific waypoint, record their finding, and then report back to base camp. A straightforward enough task. Besides, William announced, his face crumpling into a smile, their destination must be somewhere just around here. They walked in single file as the road bent to the sound of church bells in the distance. They then saw the welcome thin streams of smoking chimneys too. This approaching village had to be their destination, all three had now agreed on. Pleased at the thought of successfully completing their task, the boys passed trees and hedgerows with golden falling leaves swirling in the light breeze about them. With the seeming ease of their task, they laughed at the idea that perhaps some of their peers may be struggling with theirs. Perhaps William, Ray, and Michael might be the first ones back to base camp. To the sound of birds busy in the hedgerows, William confidently folded the map and tucked it under his armpit. They stood at the top of one side of what looked like a valley. If they took a right, it would take them down into the village of Kersey, their agreed destination. In high spirits, the boys took confident strides down the sloping street. Perhaps they'd have such luck as to find a sweet shop or village store here. The conversation beginning to wind down as they walked. They turned to each other near the bottom of the valley, the seeming center of the village, to realize they had not spoken to each other in what may have been 5 long minutes. It had occurred to William that they were not walking on the type of finished road that was typical in the modern age. They were instead on some kind of primitive wide dirt track. He scuffed his boots through the dust, it flying up to his shins, as he tried to recall when the road had deteriorated to this. Following William's lead, the boys looked back up the way they had just come, with no road but this dusty track looking back. They were now standing at the lowest point of the village, with the track in the opposite direction stretching up. At this lowest point, a shallow river flowed directly across the street, with ducks standing at its centre. There were a very small collection of timber-framed, medieval-looking houses with dense tree coverage near the water. At a first glance, other than this, there was not much else to see. William was therefore trying to work out, as his eyes scanned the scene, what it was that was not quite right. Michael's uncomfortable body language mirrored William's own as the boys made eye contact. William could not understand why it felt like someone had thrown freezing water over his body, and why he felt sick, not sick in his stomach, but rather in his chest, in his heart. William saw his discomfort, or should it be fear, reflected back in Michael's eyes, for they were both afraid. As Ray Baker drifted on, peering into odd windows, William again tried to assess what it was making him feel this way. It was quiet. Despite being a residential street, there was nobody around. The houses they passed had bare interiors, with decor not up to the most basic standards. But still, this was not it, William realized, the sick feeling in his heart growing stronger, taking root. The quiet was not just a lack of people out in the village, but rather the village itself. It was silent. Their walk so far today had been to the backdrop of hedgerows and trees rustling with life, birdsong abundant in this buoyant arable area. In this village, no birds sung, though. Why, William thought, as he walked over to Ray Baker, who was staring into a nearby window. After all, the village had many trees, especially at the bottom by the stream. He looked up at their branches waving in the light autumn wind, seemingly devoid of any life. The entire place had a sadness to it, a depression, and it seemed flat, two-dimensional. But there was more. As William stared up at the branches that were eerily swaying in the silence, his chest tightened. It was late October. The leaves should be beginning to colour and brown. Instead, all the trees around the village, of many different species, had foliage of the lightest green, the fresh colour of May. William and Michael approached Ray, who was staring through the window of a seemingly abandoned shop directly next to the river. They, too, peered through the grubby pane of glass. The shop looked empty, save for some large carcasses of meat, oxen, hanging from the ceiling. But the state of it. William's back spasmed into an arch, like one afraid. The meat had been there a long time, the entirety of it completely green with mold. The boys put their hands to their mouths in repulsion. God only knows what it would smell like behind that door. William again turned around in a circle before crossing the small stream. Where was everybody? Why would you leave good meat, expensive meat, to spoil like that? Nobody would do that. The meat had not been there a few days. It had been there a long time. The boys talked through the different possible scenarios that could have led to this. The only situation that made sense is that someone must have left or died, did not have the time to finish the job. But the building was a decent-sized shop. Surely there would be at least another person to help. Or, if not, they speculated, looking back across the water to the still, silent street. Just somebody else in the village. It had also struck William that the church bells that they had certainly heard at the top of the village were not ringing, nor were any chimneys smoking, as they had also seen rising through the sky. There were no cars, not one, no streetlights, no TV aerials, no telephone wires. Some backwater, Ray Baker murmured, kicking his shoes through the dust. But the words fell out of his mouth flat, off, not quite right. They all knew what backwaters were. This was not it. William thought again of the church bells he could not hear, and as he looked up towards the other side of the village, where the sound had certainly been coming from, there was no church that he could see through the trees. So, there were, no cars, no telephone wires, no people, no noise, no... Now that William, being a practical boy, had carefully mentally listed all the things that might be contributing towards this feeling, he realised that still, there was something else. He looked back at the houses they had just passed, as the wind blowed silently through those early green leaves. As jarring as this scene was, yes, there was still something else. William realised he had the distinct feeling that they were being watched, that unseen observers were regarding the trio. His teeth felt strange, on edge, stuck to his top lip. He could not bring himself to get a drink from his satchel. He scanned the houses with the dark windows. He then made eye contact with Michael again, to see nothing less than unbridled terror reflected back in the boy's eyes, his chest visibly rising and falling with shallow breaths. William looked to those windows again, and without speaking, all three began to pick up their pace as they moved fast up the hill away from the houses. The trio moved as fast away from the village as they could. Having made their way to the upland, they looked back again, as irrational as it may be, to check they'd not been followed. Upon regarding the village from this distance, they once again saw smoke rising from the chimneys and the spires of the nearby church visible. In 1988, William Lang, now residing in Australia, wrote a letter to researcher Andrew Mackenzie describing his unsettling experience in southwest Suffolk 31 years before. Mackenzie, intrigued by the sincerity of the letter and the strange details of the former cadet's account, delved into an investigation reaching out to the others involved, Michael Crowley and, after a good amount of digging, Ray Baker, who was still residing in London. In 1990, researcher Mackenzie and William Lang agreed to meet. Lang flew from Australia back to Britain, where he and Mackenzie journeyed to the village of Kersey. In the meantime, Mackenzie had dedicated extensive efforts to researching documents, maps, historical records, and conducting interviews with the residents of Kersey, a village with origins dating back to at least 990 AD. Mackenzie's research led to an interesting revelation coming to light. The building where the three boys had witnessed the derelict butcher's shop with the green-skinned oxen hanging in the window was now known as Bridge House, a private residence. Curiously, however, the building was confirmed to have been a butcher's shop until 1905. Mackenzie traced the building's history with the help of two other families, Cockayne and Vince, discovering its association with the butchery business, certainly from 1790 onwards, although Mackenzie also found it likely that the building had functioned as a butcher's shop with an adjoining slaughterhouse for an even longer period. What made the 1957 experience particularly eerie was then that the butcher shop had ceased operations over 50 years before October of 1957, when the three boys would stand before it. In the 50s, what the boys should have seen at this address was a busy general store and a sweet shop, which it remained until 1970. The puzzling question lingers: how could these three 15-year-old boys, who had no prior knowledge or interest in the village's history or the specific building, accurately envision a shop that had closed and since become an entirely new business half a century earlier? The cadets should also have seen several other establishments that would have been running in a 1950s Kersey, including Stiff's General Store and also two pubs. However, the cadets were adamant in stating that there was no pub, no inn, no commercial shop apart from the derelict butcher's in the Kersey as they saw it in October 1957. There are other curious features to note. There's the issue of the road. The boys reported an unsurfaced, dusty dirt track that led through the village. However, the street was first surfaced using pea shingle and tar fairly soon after the Second World War. Therefore, this primitive track would not have been there in the 1950s. The houses of Kersey in the main street are fairly close to each other, whilst the cadets' account was of far fewer houses and all well spaced apart. Nor would there have been this very dense tree coverage near the water splash. The 50s saw just a few trees in this area, as documented from pictures of this time. if you're listening to this on YouTube, have a look at your screen now as the picture is from around this time. Which also leads us to the issue of the church. St. Mary's would have certainly, without any doubt, have been visible from down in the village at this time. The boys report not being able to see it through the wooded trees, trees which again should not be here in this density. This fascinating account would go on to feature in Andrew Mackenzie's book, Adventures in Time, from 1997. Unfortunately, it is very hard to get this for less than £100, but keep an eye out for it as these things can turn up in charity shops, house clearances, etc. Again, that's Mackenzie, Adventures in Time. Since the book's publication, slowly more and more interest has been growing in the cadet's story. Whilst at first glance, it's easy to dismiss three teenage boys having wandered into, what is still today, a very old-fashioned looking village. And, perhaps they were confused by the antiquity of the buildings. But really, it is Mackenzie's labour digging around in historical records that has really breathed with force this story into Suffolk and wider England's 20th century folklore. I've mentioned some of the discrepancies between what the boys claim to have seen and what they certainly should have seen in 1957 already. But it's really the records concerning the butcher shop that are particularly interesting. Whilst there's plenty we can speculate on in the story of the cadet's adventure, the historical records of this time simply are what they are. This building, Bridge House, next to the water, was certainly a sweet shop during the 1950s. But rather than sugary displays of sweets in the shop window, which I'm sure a teenage trio likely tired from their hike would have found very welcome, they don't get this. They instead get these oxen carcasses with their green, spoiled flesh hanging there. And out of all the details in the story, it's this image that really gets under the skin, isn't it? It's extremely specific, that inexplicably spoiled green meat hanging in a ghost shop. So, it is the slew of historical inaccuracies that have collectively led this story to be commonly referred to as the Kersey time slip. Researchers have commented that the details the boys provided are not just strange or mismatched at random, but rather appear to be depicting what the village may have looked like hundreds of years before. Now, it is important to stress this time slip idea is just one interpretation. Perhaps you yourself have a different take on the boy's story. But nevertheless, it is this bizarre intersection between two very different timelines, we might say. It's this that has really caught people's imagination. And that is what this story is known as, the Kersey time slip. So, rather than go off in 70 different directions, let's briefly speak about it in the terms of which it's best known, as some kind of collision between two different timelines. So, taking the images that are handed to us, it's surely worth noting that this is a vision of what looks like a particularly bleak period in the village's history. Evidently, any community goes through economic, health, social ups and downs. This is a down. So, Kersey went on to become extremely prosperous with the Kersey wool trade, the Kersey cloth. But this isn't a vision of that economic peak, is it? Definitely not. This isn't a community on its way up. So we've got the obvious degradation, and the fact that nobody is around. But I'd also like to touch on this repeated comment that the boys felt there was something not particularly pleasant about this place. William described the village as having a feeling of sadness to it, a depression. So, you know, we're on a residential street ultimately, and even on a relatively small one like this, we should be seeing some signs of life. And that might be a good way to describe this sadness. We've got a street that's there to hold life, ultimately. That's what this collection of houses is designed to do. And yet, there isn't any. There's no blood running through this street. And a slightly poetic emblem for this is that striking image of those dead animals hanging up in the store. Have you ever been somewhere that's meant to hold a group of people and they've all gone? A great one is something like a school or university building or workplace. Oft everyone's gone home. There's a very particular uneasy feeling to it, isn't there? I'm not sure what the word for this is. I bet there is one. But then we've also got these very bizarre comments about a feeling of unreality. There's the lack of sound. Despite all those big, beautiful trees that are blocking out the view to where the church should be, there's no birdsong. We're not told that the birds are quiet or a bit subdued that day. We're told there is no birdsong. There's no countryside ambience whatsoever. The trees don't rustle, but they blow silently. The image I got from this was someone hitting mute on a TV remote. There's a discordance here, isn't there? That seems to be the right word. Discordance. It's jarring. It's not the full expression of life. William actually remarked that the scene appeared flat and two-dimensional. Again, if we take the time slip interpretation, it's like we haven't wandered into life as we know it, but it's more like a silent film that, for unknown reasons, at the lowest point of this valley next to the water, has been triggered to play. As for the feeling of the boys being watched, perhaps the village is not 100% empty. Who is looking back? One of the great things about studying stories and folklore is that it helps you think about history. The most popular interpretation is that this bizarre story from the 1950s vividly depicts different timelines for us to consider. We're right there, aren't we, in a few different worlds, our own, the 1950s, and then perhaps another, all at once. The question can be asked, what was it in the latter overlaid scene, the one with the silent trees, that might have caused a mass exodus of the population? Either death or abandonment, leaving for a better life, seem to be the two options. Researchers differ in their evaluation of what time period this scene may be depicting. To take the work of Alberto Mietello just as an example, who has collated some very interesting research on this topic, and who suggests that from the specifics of the boy's descriptions that we may be looking at a scene from the 1600s. I like that Mietello then goes on to list some of the challenges, to put it euphemistically, that people at this time may have been facing. We've got such greatest hits as the plague, the little ice age, which caused many crops to fail, and ill nutrition or starvation of rural populations. We've got a good dollop of religious persecution, as I'm sure you know. We've got diseases such as typhus, pneumonia, smallpox, dysentery, etc., all of which adversely increased by the economic crisis of the 1600s, and then, yes, along with the bubonic plague, contributed to decimate rural populations. I bring up Mietello's work not to show allegiance to his conclusions necessarily, but rather in his list of horrors there, it does serve as a reminder of what our ancestors lived through. Really, a few of those could have led to the scene the cadets described. I mean, you really wouldn't have wanted to be a poor person in 1690s England. That's a hard pass. It's something to think about as we walk through these now idyllic looking villages that seem so pristine and peaceful. Just something to keep in mind as we casually glance at those pastel painted walls with their neat flower pots outside. I mentioned at the beginning of this show that I had my reasons for wanting to include this tale. I knew as soon as I opened this season with Out of Time that I wanted to include this as an alternate take on this time theme. Unlike the stories in Out of Time, though, time doesn't seem to have gone missing here as such. As far as we know, the boys rejoined base camp and life went on as normal. Ultimately, the Kersey time slip is certainly a worthy addition to the canon of rich lore exploring unusual temporal patterns. On a more personal note, I'm actually originally from the village of Kersey, a very small place of around 350 people. We grew up very poor here. We rented one of the old weaver's cottage. I mentioned the Kersey wool trade earlier. If you don't fall into a time slip, and you do actually manage to locate the village in the modern era, it's very much worth your while. There's a great pub called The Bell. And also, if you visit the Church of St. Mary's, and if you look on one of the walls as you go in, you'll actually see my name on a list of all the children christened here. It's such a small village that all the names are just on one page. Yeah, I remember a particularly atmospheric midnight mass church service here as a child. It was all lit with candles. Yeah, and also various dodgy school plays in the church as well, you know the stuff. Anyway, I wish you a very happy Samhain or Halloween, and yeah, remember to be cautious this October if you do find yourself descending down a dusty track and all the birds stop their song. As ever, please consider adding the Kersey time slip to your folktale repertoire. You've been listening to Folkways, the Folklore of Britain and Ireland podcast, written and produced by myself, Ashley. Music by Big Big Sky. Find him on socials and streaming platforms at big.big.sky. Be sure to connect with the show on Instagram at Folkways Channel. Stay tuned for this month's almanac, which will be coming up shortly. If you'd like to hear the almanac before anyone else, be sure to head to Folkways' YouTube channel, which you'll find linked in the show notes, where the almanac is uploaded as an individual video at the beginning of each month. If you'd like the Folkways tree to grow and bear fruit, please consider watering its roots. This episode was made possible by the Friends of Folkways. Friends are excellent humans who chip in to help me afford the books I buy for each episode. If you think preserving this work is a worthwhile endeavour, you can join the Friends from only £2 a month, in return receiving instrumental soundtracks, letters in the post, and meditations. Sharing it with a pal or leaving a good rating wherever you're listening to this also helps the show to grow. Thank you. It's now time to tune into Folkways FM for October 2023's Almanac. The crew are currently somewhere near Stranraer, which comes from the Scottish Gaelic, meaning the broad headland or the fat nose. As usual, they've gone immediately to sample the public houses of the area. Hopefully they've dried out enough to put this show together. Let's find out. Welcome to October's show. Here is Spellbound by Emily Bronte to kick things off. The night is darkening round me. The wild winds coldly blow. But a tyrant's spell has bound me, and I cannot go. The giant trees are bending, their bare boughs weighed with snow, and the storm is fast descending, and yet I cannot go. Clouds beyond clouds above me, wastes beyond wastes below, but nothing drear can move me, I will not, cannot go. October from Octo 8, Old English, Winterfulleth, and the Wine Manath. Welsh, Hudrev, Cornish, Mishedra, Scots Gaelic, Indaver, Irish, Derifor, Manx, Jerry Fower. In both languages, this meaning the end of autumn or harvest. Recently, I've been looking back over old copies of Fiddler's Green, the beautiful zine from Clint Marsh and Co. There's an article I particularly like in issue 8, Ideal Hearts, by Lavanna Morgan, who writes of what we might call a consciousness-shifting practice called sitting out. This is, quote, an ancient practice that dates from the times of Britain's Saxon and Norse forebears and is frequently mentioned in old accounts. It is sometimes called hedge sitting or hedge riding. That's fantastic. At its most basic, the practice involves sitting in the landscape and communicating with that place. It can be used as a form of divination, asking questions and receiving answers, and much more. Like much of the old magic, Lavanna continues, sitting out is a deceptively simple process, but when done with intent and skill, it can produce the most profound results. Morgan then goes on to describe the practice. I won't give it away in full, as I'd love for you to go out and support Fiddler's Green by getting hold of a copy. But just to say here briefly that it involves, rather than emptying your mind, quote unquote, instead you drink in every detail of the quiet landscape you've chosen to sit in. You're not getting out of your mind, so to speak, but rather it's like the dial or the volume on the rest of the world getting turned up a bit. And it's in this state that flashes of inspiration, answers to questions, and even communication with spirits may be had. Morgan gives credit to the late Cecil Williamson, founder of the famous Boscastle Museum, for teaching her the practice, and she continues that choosing the right place for sitting out is crucial. As you look, take the old name hedge sitting, I love that, as an important clue, because the best places for sitting out are liminal spaces on the edge between one place and another. These boundaries might include hedgerows, riverbanks, the edges of woodlands, and the tide line. They are also the kind of places you can walk past without noticing them, almost as if they are not there. She continues, I live in the rural southwest and I have several quiet places I like to go. One is on the margin of an old forest, another beneath a line of big hawthorn trees that must have once been a hedge between two fields, and another a quiet bit of seashore between two beaches. The reason I'm bringing this up is that Morgan speaks of noticing the changing personality of the landscape at different times of the year, and that, quote, in the weeks leading up to Samhain, my place at the edge of the forest has a strong, dark pulse that I know will make for an intense experience. Prodding around these liminal spaces at this liminal time may be appealing to some of the Almanac's listeners, especially with the work the Folkways main show has done on liminality so far. And again, I'd like to direct you to Fiddler's Green Zine to enjoy Morgan's work in full. Happy hedge riding! If you woke up in Portishead at the beginning of October, you saw the sunrise at 7:15 and set at 18:45. Portrush, sunrise 7:30 and sunset 1900. And Perth, sunrise 7:20 and sunset 18:45. The moon is new on October the 14th. It will then be full again on the 28th of October, just in time for Samhain. This moon is known as the Hunter's Moon or the Blood Moon. This used to be the time we prepared for the coming winter by hunting, slaughtering livestock, and preserving meat for food, thus giving October's moon these names. The large constellations of Pegasus, Aquarius, and Pisces appear in the southeast soon after dark and now dominate the southern sky through the night. Looking to our hedgerows, find sloes this time of year. Of course, it is mushroom season. Find coconut-scented milk cap, slippery jack, field and wood bluets, and meadow wax cap, amongst others. It is also chestnut season from mid-October, so bags and baskets at the ready. On November the 1st, it is the next cross-quarter date after Lunasa, Samhain Calangaeaf, or Halloween, the eve of which, October the 31st, is pretty well known. This is definitely the best time of the year, isn't it? I personally find there can be a bit of a stagnancy to summer, whereas this time of the year, the world is in fast motion once again. I've been enjoying feeling the wind change this past month, And you know, living out here on the water, it can get pretty biting. To anyone new to the show, Samhain, or All Hallows, was the old gateway to winter, a potent liminal time when communion with the ancestors and other spirits was believed to be possible. The veils are the thinnest, as they say, at this time. Woo! You see this line repeated endlessly at this time of the year, from local newspapers to chic housekeeping magazines and fashion mags, where you'll get a kind of autumnal themed photo shoot. And in the text, yeah, you'll get this line, "Now the veils are the thinnest," with a kind of orange and brown and camel themed clothes. And I've always wondered about this line, "the veils are the thinnest," because we never really learn any more than that. The veils between where? This is a part of our cultural heritage that has just spilled over just a tiny bit. The fact that that's even featured at all, for example, in a fashion magazine, might be of note. But I always find that interesting, that this ancient festival of Samhain Calangaeaf has made its way into mainstream culture, even in this watered-down fashion. But yeah, just look out for it. The veils are the thinnest. Well, between where? Of course, if you're a listener to the Folkways main show, you'll have no trouble answering that question. This heightened link to the other side is why we have so many folk practices at this time period, which focus on both connecting with the ancestors, whilst also driving unsavoury ghosts, ghouls and goblins away from the threshold of the home. October the 31st, or Nos Calangaeaf in Welsh, Winter's Eve, was believed to be a somewhat dangerous time for this reason. And I would like to point you in the direction of two Folkways episodes that would make appropriate seasonal listening. Whilst you carve out pumpkins or make some toffee apples this month, you know, finally getting rid of your back molars once and for all, why not listen to Season 2, Episode 4, Dead Can Dance, where the show looks at the connection between the other world and the dead. In particular, you'll hear some slightly unsettling stories which are specifically based around this time period, the gateway to winter. Also, Season 2, Episode 5, where the liminal is discussed, and again, Samhain gets more than a few mentions. So, from now to the beginning of November, stay safe, avoid wandering off into the other world on the 31st, which stories tell us can be easily done. Don't leave us, we need you here. By the way, if the Folkways narrator, that's my second cousin, if she just, this might seem a bit out there, but if she said anything disparaging about me, I'm sure she didn't, but just in case she did, about my drinking, it's nothing, we've had a few disagreements about the amount of time the crew, it doesn't matter, but she said something about work ethic being a problem. You know, we sometimes get inspiration. We like to check out the local scene, check out some of the local pubs, but you know, it's not a big deal, but I just wanted, in case she'd said anything, it's not what you think. It's
Jeepers, get the butter out.